Sophia, that was wonderful. Thank you for sharing that. I am so honored to be sharing a table, sharing a platform up here with these two amazing souls, brilliant minds, and so grateful to have this opportunity, the opportunity of Tatisha's work, to bring both of you together here at the museum, and to be able to dive into some of the complexities and some of the joys that is language and words, which Sonia just so beautifully gave us an experience of, the power of that in this room and the power of bringing that into this space. Before we go into the next kind of 30 minutes or so of conversation together, I had asked Tatish to really situate us within, for anyone who hasn't had the chance to see Covering Letter, to see and experience this installation, and Emily did a great introduction, thank you. But for Tatish to just share with us a little bit deeper about this work, what it is, what you might experience when you go into the galleries, and some of the impulses that led to that.
First of all, Sonia, thank you so much. This is incredible. I mean, just the echo of the voice with the word and the kind of the echo of imagery that kind of followed the trail of each word was incredible, especially the way you invoked Mangechi's work. So I feel privileged and honored and very thankful also to be with Amanda, with who I shared this incredible months of conversations and dialogue leading up to this exhibition. Covering Letter essentially is a space of darkness. It's in fact an interplay of darkness and light, where within the luminosity, one, as one walks in, of course, sees this cascade of words inverted. So there's a degree of illegibility that one encounters as one walks in. But in the film of mist that sits in the middle of the room, essentially the words become readable, but at the bottom they are fairly illegible. And as they rise and ascend, they gain greater legibility in that film of descending mist. But as it gains full legibility, they depart. And so in this perennially sort of atomizing letter, which takes the form of this, well, in some ways it's really an interplay of molecules of water with photons of light, that as one walks in, of course, one only steps into the words, in this cascade of words, but as one progressively moves closer to the film of mist, one is also progressively illuminated. When one's body is fully illuminated, at that moment one is in the interface between the letter and the two individuals who authored and the intended recipient. And in some ways I think of that moment, this the traversing of through that letter as somewhat being perhaps an opportunity to probably briefly inhabit that long corridor of human possibility, from this proponent of peace reaching out to a perpetrator of violence, cohabiting the planet at that same moment in time, and perhaps for us to harness that long corridor in ourselves, maybe in some ways.
Mm-hmm. And I think one of the things that we had talked about is just kind of really starting this conversation with trying to navigate within the context of both of your works and life really dedicated to words and language, understanding the power of words and language within the context of poetry, within the context of an art installation, and how you really see mobilizing and utilizing that power in your own work. And I think, you know, Tatish, you're describing aesthetic decisions that you made for this installation where legibility and illegibility, visibility and invisibility is being played with. And that is part of that experience of reading and experiencing these words from Gandhi to Hitler. And I think with Sonia, what you articulated in one of your earlier readings from your brother is also what he was sharing with you, and what he, when he started to speak a language that has now been erased and is continuously being erased, and language, that use of that language and the articulation of that out loud becomes a form of power.
And what was, you know, it's hard to just choose a little section of that book, because it goes, you know, and it tells a story there. But my brother actually said to me when I flew in, and they said he was near death. He said, there are people in the room with me. And I said, he's hallucinating. I'm sorry if I can't look like this. I'm not trying to move the chair because it messes with my, yeah, okay, now. Otherwise, I'm going to drop off. I thought he was hallucinating. And that's what I said, and I said, yeah, why did no people in the interview, whatever, etc. The interesting thing about being an artist is that when I'm writing the bloody book, right, that I remembered that, because I made a note in a notebook, right? And it hit me that the ancestors had been in there with him, you know, and usually when I'm writing, I do two books at the same time, because one is not working, the other one is usually working. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. And that book gave me so much trouble, especially when the ancestors came. And when I was writing the book, I had this very romantic idea about ancestors. By God, by G, they said, we're your ancestors, we love you. You know, whatever. They came in hot, like boom, 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 boom. It scared me that I literally took my writing pad, whatever, stuck it in my desk, locked the desk, and went into the small library that I had on the second floor and started to write, what book was that? I don't know, Wounded the House of Flame, because there were no ancestors roaming in there, whatever. And I figured I could handle that. The words were just that crazy. But what happened when we think about art and music, you know, and nature, I was coming in from Temple one night, and WRTI, the guy said, we're now going to have a song from the ancestors. And it started out, boom, 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 boom. I said, just like my ancestors, right? You know. And then I slowed down, and I started to drive quite slowly, and turned it up. And people behind me coming abroad were honking their horn, like, I did this, and I had to say, you know. When I came up next to him, I waved to him, you know, and sang to him. But by the time I got home, I understood the ancestors' anger, that they were angry. They were saying things like, you know, where's the memorial for us? You know, what have you done to remember us? I mean, like, boom, boom, boom. And I went upstairs, I pulled the thing out of the, I mean, I almost broke my mouth, right? I sat down, and I just literally, you know, in a trance, wrote those questions down. And the book started again at some point. So, you know, the combination of music got me started again. And then I had to call people who spoke Wolof, because most certainly I don't speak Wolof, whatever. And I said, you know, I need very much to say this. And not only do I need to say this, it needs to rhyme also too, right? And that happened. What I'm saying on many levels is that there is always this intersection of history and history, right? And for me, always when I'm writing music, I always have music when I'm writing. And I used to put in margins to be sung, to be hung, you know, whatever. And it took me years finally to finally, you know, sing, literally sing when I read. At some point, I was released to do it. It's a long, long story that I won't tell, but it was. And so I started to do that, and I began to truly understand the correlation with the music, you know, with the fog, which is also music, you know. And you know, if you've ever been in San Francisco in the summer, or in London, you know, and you look out the window, fog comes in, and initially it just hit me, and I thought I was going to die. But then you live with it for a while, you hear the music of the fog. You know, it signals through the open window, you know, and come on, you know, and taste this. Taste what I'm saying to you, what I'm doing with you, and you learn how to live with it, you know.
Well, one of the things I was thinking about was like the aesthetic decisions and the formal decisions that you made, Jitesh, that you just described about how you wanted that experience of the work itself, of this letter, that we could very, I mean, it's printed in the brochure, you can very easily, you can find it on Google, you could read it. But for you, Jitesh, it was very much about not just simply reading it, but having that kind of choreography of an experience. And I think, you know, Sonia, you're describing this way, this kind of thinking about voice, thinking of rhyme, thinking of different ways of experiencing a word, which I think, you know, that choreography is so much about how you come to interact with these words that are either on a page or spoken out loud.
Yeah, in fact, it's interesting that Sonia ended a performance with a sound. Mm-hmm. And I think, in fact, in sort of returning to a point, in a way, you know, a sound that kind of echoed, kind of, you know, so in some ways, if we really also with Kavilet, especially when we thought of fog as sound, it just made me think that if there's one kind of singular metronome, it is essentially the descending that then allows within a sort of creates a sort of temporal rhythm through which I think the words can unfold or unveil itself through these degrees of legibility across the room.
You know, I'm always so surprised if you in fog, you hear the fog, you know how they do the foghorn? And I used to always say, don't, no foghorn. I mean, I know how they do it, you know, in terms of safety. But the fog makes its own sounds. You know, you should, the next time you're in San Fran or London, whatever, that fog makes a sound. And I got used to that sound. And, you know, I will not survive the summer, is what I said, right? With the fog. Until finally I realized that I welcomed that sound because it meant a certain time of day, a night also, but it also meant that I was being protected. Very much so, you know, it was not a frightening kind of thing. And that sound was a soft music. It was like a hum. And I remember when my grandmother, who raised me for a number of years in a place called Alabama, that she would hum, you know, and I couldn't figure out why she always would hum. And one day I was in a terrible situation at a reading, that someone was really saying some real racist stuff, you know, and no one was saying anything. And everyone knows I speak up all the time. So my children were sitting next to me and they kind of looked at me, don't say anything, Mom, you know. So I started to hum. I started to hum, and people heard the humming, whatever, and I hummed. It was like my way of pushing back of what that sickness that person was spewing out, you know, there. That singing, that humming is always a cleansing kind of thing that goes on.
Well, one of the things when we were talking on the phone, Sonia, I told you I was going to bring this up, so, and just kind of trying to think of, you know, how do we, what kind of conversation do we want to have tonight? What does this work bring up? And you bringing up the metronome and this kind of humming, something that is a kind of stability in the midst of instability. One of the things that you said is I'm doing what I have to keep going, I have to keep doing in the midst of this time, because we have to keep the earth sane and we have to keep ourselves human. Mm. And whether that's humming, whether that, you know, what are those things that keep us grounded, that keep us human, that keep us sane, and that give us this sense of, you know, peace, perhaps, or stability in the midst of instability. And I wanted to kind of, for us to dive a little bit deeper into the real, not just the structure of these words themselves, but really what this is bringing up and what this letter from Gandhi to Hitler is really a call for peace and nonviolence in the midst or in the wake of an incredibly violent time. And so maybe for us to talk about, you know, what are the possibilities that we can talk about today for disagreement for two individuals like Gandhi and Hitler who are incredibly on different spectrums, as you kind of describe where you occupy yourself when you experience this work between peace and violence. But, you know, what are the possibilities for disagreement today? What does that look like? And in the midst of that, what keeps us grounded? What keeps us sane?
Well, I always call on. I had a conversation 2 weeks ago with Ta-Nehisi Coates up in New York. And we had I was working with one of the theater companies up in New York City, and I suggested that we do a conversation with Sister Toni Morrison and Sister Bernice Reagan, because we've done it up in UMass. And we had about 3,500 people looking at us, you know, three women just talking sanity. No one was cursing, no one was saying yo-yo, and what we see on the indie box, you know. And reminded me so much of Tony K. Bambara, who said that she was invited out to Hollywood to come and do a series, write a series, right? Mm-hmm. And anyone who knows Tony K. Bambara's writing, that she's really a great writer and very precise, you know, what she does. If you don't know, Google her. That's what you do, you Google everybody, right? And she got there, and she had passed out the scripts to people, to all these big-time people who were going to do this movie. And, you know, and they had read it already. They got the piece, and one of the men said, well, you know, you write well. And they said we wrote well, she was recommended. But black people don't talk like this. But where's the yo and the whoa, whatever? And Tony said she looked at them, and she went to started to explain what this is about. And they said, no, we need the yo and woe and ho and what and no curse words and whatever. So she said, she got up and she packed up the manuscripts and they put her up at a great hotel. And she began to use everything in the bar, you know, whatever. And then got refilled or whatever. And she packed up all the little bottles to take home. And it is the presumption that people have about your culture, which is alarming, you know, sometimes. It is the presumption that those men sitting there were going to tell her how black people spoke, you know, and what their culture was, which was quite alarming to her. And she came back, you know, and we talked about it. In fact, we actually had a meeting at my house about, you know, we who write and what does this mean, how people assume that this is how we speak, this is what we do, you know, this is what this is about. And, you know, I feel at some point that it's incumbent upon us to always move within, you know, what we know about people and not assume other things about them or what they already see on that idiot box. I don't know exactly how I can describe the horror on Tony's face, but what I can describe sometimes, you know, is the horror of what I see on the idiot box, whatever. And the very unpeaceful way people deal with each other, the unpeaceful words that are thrown out at each other. And I said, when I was having a long conversation, I was like, you know, Sonia Sanchez, you know, I remember your first books, you cursed everybody. I said, yeah, I did, because people were MFs, you know what I mean, you know? And they need to be called. Not the same word, you know, whatever. But they need to be called, they need to be called out as what they were about. But if 30 years later, I am still doing that, there's something wrong with me. You know what I'm saying? And there's something wrong with you expecting me to still do that also too, and not allow me to do other kinds of things. So it is this language that we do, these words that we bring to people, the peace that we try to bring to people, the words that are not violent at all. When I read both those letters, I thought to myself, I had with a dear friend who's a famous writer, we had a constant conversation about evil. She said people are evil, some people are evil, and I was saying, no, people have hard lives. You know, they might do some terrible things every day, but people are not evil. And she would say, oh, no. People are evil, Sonia. And I tell you, you know, living all these years, or maybe two now, living all these years, I must agree with her, but there is evil in the world, people, you know. And it is evil that people sometimes don't want to acknowledge, and people don't want to live with it. And when I heard about this exhibit, I thought to myself, how do you exhibit in an exhibit, right? You know, peace, you know, hitting evil, or peace hitting someone who is perpetrating death throughout Europe. How can you be nonviolent, right, and say that this is how I am going to live and how I am going to be on this earth and how I'm going to bring peace to this earth, but there are people who have no idea what peace means, right? It's never been brought to their attention, or if they do, the economics of a country will make them forget the whole idea of peace, you know, and humanity. And the one thing that you and I know that art does is that we constantly bring up the idea of what does it mean to be human, to walk upright. What does it mean? As someone said, someone spoke very rudely to me the other day, and I said to the person, I am so sorry. Will you please tell me how I offended you so I can correct it? And later on, this writer said, oh God, Sonia, I am so tired of you and your peace mode. I was waiting for you to curse them out. And I said very gently, you do remember that I was the one who did that for all us on stages, you know. But I said, at some point, you should look at me and say, if I'm still doing that, there's something wrong with me and my motion and movement. Because the rest of you applauded me on stage with me, but you didn't say what I said. And so at some point, there is a time and a role that you do things and say things perhaps to advance the conversation or to advance where we are. But there's a time also too that you begin to understand, you know, Brother Martin, you know, Gandhi, and all the people and the brothers, the priests, the ones who just died recently. Oh gosh. The Bergen brothers, who were amazing, amazing men. And the joy of my life was to be on stage with them, you know, and to talk about peace with them, you know, within the context of this country, which is very difficult. It's not easy to do that.
Yeah. Yeah. I think I was just thinking about this whole epidemic of preconception that then sets the conversation on certain modes that then leads us to this kind of extremely sort of oxymoronic world that we inhabit now, because, you know, we are agitated peace activists, or we become, you know, we sort of, you know, send, you know, battalions of soldiers to inflict war on terror, and assume that we can actually buy spewing poison, let poison work as antidote, which it may not, unless we know what is the antidote. Until we recognize the antidote, it would be poison. So I think it's really a peculiar world. I think it's a global phenomenon, I think, all over the world. And yet, I mean, there's always a question of, you know, like, how do you, like, what do you do when you make art? I mean, there's always a question, do you make art because you respond to a world that seems oxymoronic, or you make art because you want to sort of make sense of the world, you know, just kind of, you wake up in the morning and, you know, you hope that this, what you're looking at is going to tell you something that you hadn't known before you looked at it, you know, and in that, and I think it's the perennial hazard of being the kind of species we are, that we want legitimately to access fundamental reality and truth. That's what we seek. And yet we are, in a way, incompetent to absorb reality and truth in its entirety. So I think we then start looking for truth in the relative. We look for small things that can tell us something more about the bigger picture, about the bigger truth. And I think as artists, I think we're always looking for those little things that we can tunnel our vision onto, so that despite the tunnel vision, the prolonged gaze that we might apply to that little object or that impulse can in some ways kind of, morph, you know, into something else that becomes an experience, an object, a sound, a word, a piece of poetry or a piece of work.
And we have to go beyond just what we see. You know, just what we see. You know, at some point we have to have vision. You know, we have to have a vision for this world, for this bloody country that we're in. You know, and we don't. point. And we have to be willing sometimes to get out in the street to talk about that vision, whatever. Mm-hmm. And that's how, you know, I taught at Temple. I entered my career teaching. I've been all over this country teaching, primarily, as my father said, because I wouldn't shut up. You know, my dad would say, Sonia, if you just teach the literature, right, you'll be okay. Just teach the creative writing, you'll be okay. Just teach the theme of women's studies, whatever. You insist on bringing something else into it. And I said, if I don't do that, I can't teach, you know.
Yeah.
But, you know, Temple one year decided that all the full professors had to teach comp. You know, it was some big ado there, right? So I hadn't done comp in years, so I walked into a class of comp. 24 students looking at me. All males except for one female, whatever. They looked at me, right? And I'm sure they were saying, their eyes would say, what am I doing here with her, right? So I went and wrote my name on the board, and I turned and said, if you don't want to stay, stay with me 1 week. If you want to stay, I'll let you out. You know, you can go someplace else, whatever, with no problem at all, period. But I said, one thing I will do, I will teach you how to write, which means you will graduate. Because that's all university is, learning how to write, period, whatever, you know. And I incorporated Jimmy Baldwin and all those great writers, Toni Morrison, people in to that class. And what was so amazing, these young men, all from the Northeast, whatever. About 3 weeks into the class, I'd be walking across campus and this voice said, yo, prof, how are you? And I used to always say to them when I came in, how you be, on purpose, right? And then they would say, how you be? Professor Sanchez, and I would say, I be fine, who are you? You know, always slipping in a little black English every now and then. But the point that I'm making is that one of the things that I told Ta-Nehisi is that when you write, you end up eventually teaching, and he's going to be teaching at NYU. And the thing you will learn about teaching is that it will change your life, people. People will come into your classroom with set ideas about you. And you don't realize you have maybe some set ideas about them too. But that interaction that happens in that classroom is the most beautiful thing that happens, almost as much as what I feel when I write. You know? And within that interaction there, you see the ideas blooming and people beginning to look at each other as human beings. Not as someone from North Philadelphia, or not the Northeast or South Philadelphia, but putting them in committees together, you know, whatever, making them work through, you know, anything. When it comes up, when racism came up, we stopped the class, wrote it on the board, telling them the definition of a sucker. What does this mean? You know, and why are you saying that? And what makes, well, whatever. So what I'm saying at some point, it is difficult. People get lost in just activism. They get lost in just being in the streets. Whatever, you know, screaming at each other, throwing things at each other. But we've got to get lost also in the whole idea, wherever we are, we walk upright as human beings. I don't care where you be, you know, I don't care where you are, you know, in an office, wherever you are, in a classroom, you got to insist that your students not only get the information from those books, but the information about the books are going to lead you to a certain place, but I'm going to try to lead you beyond some of these books too. And that we've got to maintain this bloody earth. You know, we've got to maintain the earth inside of us, you know, the balance inside of us also too. We've got to maintain the balance on this earth. And when we know something's wrong, we've got to change it and say something about it. And my dad, coming full circle,
take your time, Sonia.
My dad, in the last year, said to me one Sunday when the sun was setting, he lived on the top floor. He said, read that book. what book you meant. It was the book, Does Your Heart Supply Lions? I had done a couple other books for y'all, but I knew he'd never asked me to read that book. And I need glasses to read. But on that day, I didn't need glasses to read. I read that book, and he said to me, you got me right, Sonia, finally. And I understood that, but I got up and said to him, forgive me for those early poems that I wrote when I didn't get you right, you know. And he said, forgive me for not understanding what you were trying to do. I understand it now. And that forgiveness was so important to me. And also forgiveness we must do for each other. You know?
Thank you for sharing that, Sonia, and for being vulnerable with us in that. Because I think that when we talk about disagreement in the moment, that we're in right now, when we talk about what you said to me before was we need thinkers, not followers. When you're talking about what you do in the classroom and what, you know, what you try to do with those who you teach is not to create followers, to create thinkers, to create visionaries. And that visioning, that individual and collective imagination that we do together is messy. It's not always certain. And we sometimes fail, but we have to be able to do it together and to be able to do it out loud and to be able to do it in spaces, many spaces, in the streets, in the museums, and to be able to continue to create and to support visions for the future of the places that we live.
Can I ask a question?
Okay.
Which I was like, were you satisfied with what you did?
Yes.
I think so. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's you know, it's a bit strange that it's even out there.
Uh-huh.
Because when I look back, you know, 5, 6, 7 years, 2010, 11. Whenever it was that I first saw this letter, you see pieces of paper, and you know, you see letters, and you'll see all of that all the time. And you know, we also know from experience that few things remain with you. And in a way, this letter remained. And it almost seemed like it's there to be kind of posted how it mailed out. And you know, I also knew that it needs a form that was formless. That's all I knew. I kind of knew that it needed a form that you could walk through. But I didn't know what that would be, you know. And at the time, I remember this was sometime in 2011, at the Kennedy Center in Washington. You know, there was this conversation of doing a project, and I did something else. So a piece called Public Notice 2 in the Hall of Nations. But, you know, trying hard to realize this piece, there was no way, it didn't have a form, it was just this nebulous thing in the head. So to have this out there, and in a way, have that self-addressed envelope come back, you know, is satisfying. So, yeah.